In addition to the marching and concert bands, I joined our dance band, the Stardusters. I spent a year dueling for first chair on tenor sax with Larry McDougall, who looked as if he should have played backup for Buddy Holly. He had a ducktail hairdo, crew cut on top, long hair greased back on the sides. When he stood for a solo, he gyrated and played with a blaring tone, more like hardcore rock and roll than jazz or swing. I wasn't as good as he was in 1961, but I was determined to get better. That year, we entered a competition with other jazz bands in Camden in South Arkansas. I had a small solo on a slow, pretty piece. At the end of the performance, to my astonishment, I won the prize for Best Sweet Soloist. By the next year, I had improved enough to be first chair in the All-State Band, a position I won again as a senior. The summer after my junior year, I attended the annual week-long American Legion Boy State program at Camp Robinson, an old army camp with enough primitive wooden barracks to house 1,000 16-year-old boys. We were organized by cities and counties, divided equally into two political parties, and introduced as candidates and voters to local, county, and state politics. We also developed platforms and voted on issues. We heard addresses from important figures from the governor on down and got to spend one day at the state capitol, during which the Boy State governor, the other elected officials and their staffs, and the legislators actually got to occupy the state offices and legislative chambers. At the end of the week, both parties nominated two candidates for the Boys Nation program, to be held toward the end of July at the University of Maryland in College Park near the nation's capital. An election was held, and the two top vote-getters got to go as Arkansas's senators. I was one of them. It was during this summer with Boys Nation that I first visited Washington. On Wednesday, July 24th, we went to the White House to meet the President in the Rose Garden. President Kennedy walked out of the Oval Office into the bright sunshine and made some brief remarks, complimenting our work, especially our support for civil rights, and giving us higher marks than the governors, who had not been so forward-leaning in their annual summer meeting. After accepting a Boys Nation T-shirt, Kennedy walked down the steps and began shaking hands. I was in the front, and being bigger and a bigger supporter of the President's than most of the others, I made sure I'd get to shake his hand, even if he only shook two or three. It was an amazing moment for me, meeting the president whom I had supported in my ninth-grade class debates, and about whom I felt even more strongly after his 2.5 years in office. A friend took a photo for me, and later we found film footage of the handshake in the Kennedy Library. Much has been made of that brief encounter and its impact on my life. My mother said she knew when I came home that I was determined to go into politics. And after I became the Democratic nominee in 1992, the film was widely pointed to as the beginning of my presidential aspirations. I'm not sure about that. I have a copy of the speech I gave to the American Legion in Hot Springs after I came home, and in it I didn't make too much of the handshake. I thought at the time I wanted to become a senator. But deep down I probably felt as Abraham Lincoln did when he wrote as a young man, "I will study and get ready, and perhaps my chance will come." One other memorable event happened to me in the summer of 1963. On August the 28th, 9 days after I turned 17, I sat alone in a big white reclining chair in our den and watched the greatest speech of my lifetime, as Martin Luther King Jr. stood in front of the Lincoln Memorial and spoke of his dream for America. In rhythmic cadences reminiscent of old Negro spirituals, his voice at once booming and shaking, he told the vast throng before him and millions like me transfixed before television sets of his dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood, and that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I started crying during the speech and wept for a good while after Dr. King finished. He had said everything I believed far better than I ever could. More than anything I ever experienced, except perhaps the power of my grandfather's example, that speech steeled my determination to do whatever I could for the rest of my life to make Martin Luther King's dream come true. On November 22nd, our calculus teacher, Mr. Coe, was called out of class to the office. When he returned, he was white as a sheet and could hardly speak. He told us President Kennedy had been shot and probably killed in Dallas. I was devastated. Just 4 months before, I had seen him in the Rose Garden, so full of life and strength. So much of what he did and said, the inaugural address, the Alliance for Progress in Latin America, the cool handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Peace Corps, the stunning line from the Ich bin ein Berliner speech. Freedom has many difficulties, and democracy is not perfect. But we have never had to put a wall up to keep our people in. All these embodied my hopes for my country and my belief in politics. After class, all the students in the annex where our class met walked back to the main building. We were all so sad, all of us but one. I overheard an attractive girl who was in the band with me say maybe it was a good thing for the country that he was gone. I knew her family was more conservative than I was, but I was stunned and very angry that someone I considered a friend would say such a thing. It was my first exposure beyond raw racism to the kind of hatred I would see a lot of in my political career, and that was forged into a powerful political movement in the last quarter of the 20th century. I'm thankful that my friend outgrew it. When I was campaigning in Las Vegas in 1992, she came to one of my events. She'd become a social worker and a Democrat. I treasured our reunion and the chance it gave me to heal an old wound. As my senior year drew to a close, I became increasingly anxious about college. For some reason, I never even considered applying to any Ivy League school. I knew just where I wanted to go, and I applied only there, the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. I didn't want to go into the Foreign Service, and I had never even seen the Georgetown campus when I was at Boys Nation. But I wanted to go back to Washington. Georgetown had the best academic reputation in the city. The intellectual rigor of the Jesuits was legendary and fascinating to me, and I felt that I needed to know all I could about international affairs, and that somehow I would absorb all I could learn about domestic issues just by being in Washington in the mid-60s. In the second week of April, my acceptance notice from Georgetown arrived. I was happy, but by then I'd begun to question the wisdom of going. I didn't get a scholarship, and it was so expensive. $1,200 for tuition and $700 for room and fees, plus books, food, and other expenses. Although we were a comfortable middle-class family by Arkansas standards, I was worried that my folks couldn't afford it. And I was worried about being so far away and leaving Mother and Roger alone with Daddy, though age was slowing him down. My guidance counselor, Edith Irons, was adamant that I should go, and that it was an investment in my future that my parents should make. Mother and Daddy agreed. Also, Mother was convinced that once I got there and proved myself, I'd get some financial help. So I decided to give it a shot. In my first 2 years at Georgetown, I rarely ventured beyond the confines of the university and its immediate surroundings, a small area bordered by M Street and the Potomac River to the south, Q Street to the north, Wisconsin Avenue to the east, and the university to the west. Though occasionally I felt cooped up in Georgetown, most days I was happy as a clam, absorbed in my classes and friends. However, I was also grateful for my few trips out of the cocoon. Several weeks into my first semester, I went to the Lisner Auditorium to hear Judy Collins sing. I can still see her standing alone on the stage with her long blonde hair, floor-length cotton dress, and guitar. From that day on, I was a huge Judy Collins fan. In December 1978, Hillary and I were on a brief vacation to London after the first time I was elected governor. One day, as we window-shopped down the King's Road in Chelsea, the loudspeaker of a store blared out Judy's version of Joni Mitchell's Chelsea Morning. We agreed on the spot that if we ever had a daughter, we'd call her Chelsea. At the end of sophomore year in 1966, I went home without a job, but with a clear idea of what I wanted to do. It was the end of an era in Arkansas. After 6 terms, Orville Faubus wasn't running for re-election as governor. Finally, our state would have a chance to move beyond the scars of Little Rock and the stains of cronyism that also tainted his later years. I wanted to work in the governor's race, both to learn about politics and to do what little I could to put Arkansas on a more progressive course. The best candidate with a good shot at winning was a state Supreme Court justice and a former attorney general, Frank Holt. He had the support of most of the courthouse crowd and the big financial interest, but he was more progressive on race than Faubus and completely honest and decent. Frank Holt was admired by just about everybody who knew him, except those who thought he was too easygoing to make any real change. He'd wanted to be governor all his life, and also wanted to redeem his family's legacy. His brother Jack, who was more of an old-fashioned Southern populist, had lost a hot Senate race to our conservative senior senator, John McClellan, a few years before. My uncle Raymond Clinton was a big supporter of Holt's, and told me he thought he could get me on the campaign. Holt already had secured the support of a number of student leaders from Arkansas colleges who called themselves the Holt Generation. Before long, I got hired, at $50 a week. I think Uncle Raymond paid my way. Since I'd been living on $25 a week at Georgetown, I felt rich.